Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife with Scott Craven, Meredith's Wildlife Specialist with the University of Wisconsin Extension. Great to have him back, and certainly thank you so much for tuning in today as we talk about wildlife. You may have a wildlife question. Maybe you've got a sighting. Have you seen any of those snowy owls? A lot of people have here in the state. That's one thing you might talk about. And there's a whole lot more. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. If you have some photos, wildlife photos, you want to post on our Facebook page, that'd be wonderful. We already have several up. Go to the Larry Mueller Show. You can post photos there, and you can also ask questions there as well. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Scott Craven, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Hello, Larry. It's always good to be here.
You know, you can say this weather. Wow. On the weather, got to be one of the easiest winters for wildlife in a
long time. It's just bizarre, but I'll tell you, I took the dogs out for a run yesterday afternoon. That's one of the advantages of not having to be at the office every day, and it was just beautiful out, almost shirt-sleeve weather, at least it seemed like it, and it is excellent news for many wildlife species. There could be some downsides. I mean, if the snow cover goes and then it really gets cold and the frost penetrates deeply, that's bad news for frogs and things like that.
Yeah.
And the snow cover does protect some of our small mammals. But for the most part, for the species that have been hammered last few really snowy, really cold winters, pheasants and southern fringe species like bobwhite quail, possums, things like that, this is a nice winter.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's certainly, I'm not complaining about not shoveling.
Well,
it's been great.
And I'm thinking tomorrow, Jimmy the Groundhog, it's Groundhog Day tomorrow. And, of course, Jimmy the Groundhog in Sun Prairie is one of the national figures. And somebody asked me, what is a groundhog anyway?
The two common names, groundhog and woodchuck, I think most people probably know them better by the woodchuck term. But basically, they're a big fat rodent, essentially a big fat ground squirrel. And surprisingly, for their rotund stature and short legs, they do climb very well, and they certainly, everybody knows how well they dig.
Yeah.
And, of course, their claim to fame this time of year is that they presumably emerge from a deep sleep and check things out, and if they see their shadow, meaning it's sunny and presumably a cold Arctic high-pressure system, then, oh, six more weeks of winter. But if it's gloomy and cloudy and there's a warm front, it's going to be an early spring. Well, it looks like Jimmy's going to see his shadow tomorrow, but boy, unless things turn around in a hurry, it seems like spring now. So it's an interesting bit of folklore that people cling to, but I'm not sure that all of our wild woodchucks out there are going to be doing anything tomorrow other than continuing to spend the winter in their burrows.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Punxsutawney Phil and Jimmy the Groundhog, I think, have to be awakened to get out there and take a look, see if they can see their shadows. We have Nick in Green Bay with a comment or question, so let's go there. Hi, Nick.
Hey, I got a quick question for you.
Yeah.
I've wanted for, like, the last 5 years to put up a bat house.
Mm-hmm.
But I heard they're awfully touchy in how you position them and the temperature and all this other stuff. I was wondering if you could go into detail on how touchy they really are and how long it takes them for the habitat to inhabit the
battle. Well, the last question, how long does it take to inhabit them, is impossible to answer. If you do everything right in terms of the best placement and construction and so forth, and there are bats around, occupancy rates are somewhere in the neighborhood of 50%, and there's a nice bit of information available through Bat Conservation International. You can Google them. It's the international bat conservation outfit in Austin, Texas, and there's lots of information, including a citizen science project, the Bat Research, Bat House Researchers Project, that you can get involved with. But the proper placement, there are a couple of things. First of all, generally the side of a house or building is the best location. A pole would be next. A tree is the a distant third. They don't like houses on trees, especially the colonial species like little browns, big browns, and whatnot that most people are likely to attract. So the building is the best alternative. Positioning on the building, higher is better than lower. You don't want the thing low enough that it can be tampered with or bothered by kids, pets, people, or anything else. So up under the eaves, where it's a bit sheltered, not over a window or your patio door. because, as you know, the bases of the houses are open, so the guano simply falls out, and having a constant rain of guano as you're going out to grill your burgers or whatever is not a great idea. So be careful where you put it in that regard. Generally, as far as exposure is concerned, avoid prevailing winds in a north-northwest, northeast kind of quadrant, and get it on a warmer side of the house. And it may be that you have to experiment a little bit, perhaps with darker colors to absorb a little more heat. They do like it warm, but you can always move it around a bit. And that's, I think, the best advice. If you don't get bats after a season or two, move it, change the coloration, switch things up a little bit, or put up additional houses to see what they actually select, and then go from there. And you'll be fine.
There you
go. Good luck with it.
Thank you very much for calling. Joanne in Milwaukee, it is your turn. Hi, Joanne.
Well, I had a bird in my backyard about 2.5 weeks ago, and I've never seen anything like it. I looked in the bird book. I could not find what it was. It was the size of a sparrow, shaped like a sparrow, but I called it the golden retriever because it looked like a young golden retriever in color. Pure gold, no dark markings, no nothing. Prettiest little thing I've ever seen, and it came with sparrows and juncos and the things that we're feeding in our backyard, and I have no idea what kind of bird this is.
And it was all one solid color.
Yes, it was. Hmm. The color of a golden retriever puppy. Just a slight tinge of gold. It wasn't yellow, but it was shaped like a sparrow.
Well, that's a bit of a stumper, but the good news here is that much like Do You Want to Be a Millionaire, we've got tens of thousands of very skilled and experienced birders out there listening, and we can turn to the audience here for some help. I mean, one issue, of course, is that there are color variations and various morphs of some common birds. So it's possible that if it looked like a sparrow and behaved like a sparrow and was shaped like a sparrow, that
it was a sparrow.
It was a sparrow, but some color variation for reasons that maybe we can't explain. But
like
it's also
albinism or something like that.
Well, something like that, but not white, obviously. But there are other reasons why various color morphs turn up among a variety of birds and mammals, and that's one possible explanation. I'm not suggesting
it
that's
was so pretty. It was a beautiful little bird.
Well, I'm just not thinking, especially in winter plumage, you know, something that's a few birds are a very uniform color,
right,
the way you describe, without some type of marking, a wing bar or an eye ring or something like that. So we'll see if our birders have any other suggestions, and we'll go from there.
Might have been a recent escapee, too.
Yeah, and
could be
weird,
an escapee.
Weird stuff turns up all the time, especially in mild winters like this, so let's see what the listeners might have to offer.
Thanks very
Thank
much.
You.
Yeah, for calling. Appreciate it. Kathy in Denmark, we're on to you now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks for calling.
Say, we've been feeding birds here in our new house since 1983, and I have 30 or 40 red poles that I've never had before. And is that common for them to be all the way down to Denmark? And why are they so noisy?
Well, all birds have their own behavioral qualities. Some are noisy, some are quiet, some are very active, some are somewhat sedentary. But having said that, red poles are one of our northern visitors that come down with, you know, decent winter conditions in the north, which they have had while we have not. So they're one of those things that you may see them one year and then not again for a while. And certainly you're within the range of their southern penetration, so enjoy them while you have them, and they'll be gone at some point over the next few weeks. And whether you see them again in the future, only we'll have to wait to be determined. But enjoy them while you have them.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And John in Watertown, we're on to you now. Hi, John. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, a very important question that has been bothering us for a long time. How does the mammalian mole breathe underground? And is it also difficult sometimes for, say, a chipmunk or a gopher? No one around here knows what a junco is, but how does a mole live underground and get air. We've trapped about 100 of them with what you call a harpoon trap.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, moles, it's difficult to get them all. There's, we thought we had all of them, and last year we seemed to have about a dozen new ones starting to dig again. And tell us, how do they breathe, and what is a junco?
Okay.
Well, the dark-eyed junco is a small passerine bird that's a fairly frequent winter feeder visitor, usually scratching around on the ground. They're distinctively slate gray with a white undersurface, plain but rather pretty little things.
Yeah, nice.
About the maybe a little bit bigger than a chickadee, and one of the very common, very attractive winter feeder birds. So that's the junco. On the mole front, there's nothing very mystical about this. A mole breathes air just like any other mammal, and there's enough air in porous soil that's not a problem for them. Either through their own tunnel system and infiltration of air through that, or when they're down deep in the winter and the ground's frozen, there's still enough penetration and enough porosity, essentially, in the soil that they can get enough air. It's perhaps one of the reasons why you generally don't see moles in really heavy soils, clay soils, or wet soils, because, among other things, digging's difficult, but so is air penetration. So you usually find them in loose, friable soils, and there's enough air to keep them going. Same with any other animal that spends some of its time underground.
There you go.
Excuse me, how far east do you have to go to run into the star-nosed mole?
It's not a matter of east. There are quite a few star-nosed moles in Wisconsin. They tend to be a little more in the northern two-thirds or so of the state than in the far south, but that's among the small mammals. To see a star-nosed mole up close and personal, that it is a bizarre-looking animal. And
yes, it is.
Really neat. And having said what I just said about wet soils, star-nosed mole is one of our few aquatic mammals, and they actually spend a fair bit of their time swimming around and underwater.
Mm-hmm.
And their burrow systems may actually open beneath the water line on the edge of a slow stream or pond or pool or something like that. But with those little fleshy finger-like things on the end of their nose, really a neat-looking little animal. Very few people ever get to see one alive.
Thank you for calling, John. Appreciate your call. Email from Valerie in Burnham Wood, so farther northern Wisconsin. Last weekend, I found a pile of screws about 20 feet from the backside of our garage. Asked my husband. He mentioned that a few days prior, a box of screws fell behind his workbench in the garage, and that some may have slipped past where the garage wall meets the concrete floor. Well, we were quite perplexed because I pointed out that they were 20 feet from the garage. We started looking into it further, and just outside of the garage, well, there were several small piles of screws in the snow. Only thing we can think of is that some critter, squirrels maybe, mice, were attempting to take these screws for some purpose, nesting or whatever. What do you think?
Yeah, maybe they were building a new nest. Who knows? The common hoarding little mammal that's common in people's garages and sheds and whatnot during the winter months is a white-footed mouse, or paramiscus, or field mouse, as many people call them. There are a couple of different species, but they're pretty little things. Look just like a mouse, a little bit bigger than a house mouse, bigger eyes, bigger ears, attractive color. A pretty little animal, but they do get into buildings frequently in the winter, and ordinarily they're stockpiling in my garage. They stockpile dog kibble that they take out of the food bags. They stockpile whole kernel corn that I've got sitting there that the squirrels might be destined to get, or anything else in the line of food. I've never had them pile up inanimate or inorganic material like nuts, bolts, and screws, but we could have one here that's a little bit deranged and maybe heard his buddies talking about, hey, there's a box of nuts over there on the workbench, and who knows? But if I were to blame a small mammal for this, and they're really the only ones with the physical capability to do it, it would be a white-footed mouse. Why they're doing it, I don't know. And to just get them out and leave them in the snow, they may have decided that this was something that wasn't going to pan out for them, and they abandoned the project. I'm not sure.
Scott Craven, Emeritus Wildlife Specialist with UW Extension, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Emeritus Wildlife Specialist. Great to have him along. Thank you for listening in. All our lines are filled right now, but you can get on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. If you've got a photograph, we've got a whole bunch of them to look at and to talk about, or post your question there. Perfectly fine. As a matter of fact, one of our favorite bird guests on the show is Noel Cutright, and you know Noel very well, Scott. And he wanted to share this. He has a link for snowy owls that he wanted to share. And actually, Judith posted it up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. It's the eBird range map for the snowy owl.
Right, and there's another one. Noel emailed me this morning. There's another website is just tinyurl.com/snowy owl, WITHRUJAN. So it's essentially snowy owl slash Wisconsin through January. And that was a really neat map. Every sighting in Wisconsin through January was identified with a little pin, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
You could click on the pin and find out exactly where it was and when and who saw it and so forth. And you could expand the map to the whole continent, and there were snowy owls all over the place, all over the northern tier of states and some down even further south than that. And interesting, I mean, Wisconsin was about the only state that was just solid color. It was just blanket
everywhere.
So lots of snowy owls around, and they're a neat thing to see.
And actually, I think that's the site that he sent.
That is it. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. So
we're good.
Go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. It says eBird Range Map Snowy Owl, and you can take a look at that. And James, also on our Facebook page, sent in some things. He saw a snowy owl perched on a power line in town one winter, a spectacular sight. He created some pieces depicting many common and uncommon birds, and recently finished a paper collage of a snowy owl that he's sharing with us. So we've got that, too, to
Pretty
look
neat.
At on our... Yeah, thanks, James, for sending that along. Karen in Random Lake... It is your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I've got a mystery. I had a coyote show up about 3 weeks ago. I live out in the country. And one of my chickens disappeared, so I assumed that, you know, he had had a feast on that. And I saw him out near the dairy barn, so I got a little bit concerned about my barn cats. And so I locked them into their cat room, which has a door. And I put a piece of plywood in front of the door and a cinder block behind it to hold it shut. And the next morning when I went out to feed the cats, the cinder block was pushed away and the piece of plywood was slipped onto the other side. Could that be a raccoon?
It could be. A big old mature 40-pound raccoon is a pretty powerful animal.
Yeah.
So's a coyote.
Well, this was kind of a small coyote.
But
could have had some
even
friends,
so, too. I mean, either animal could probably has the strength to do that. But
oh, is that right?
If it's in an area where there's loose soil and all, I would think that what's going to clue you in to who's doing what are the tracks.
There was an inside door, so there was it's a concrete.
But even so, if that kind of thing happens again or you think it might, you have two options. One is to borrow a trail camera from somebody, mm-hmm. and they're fairly common these days, and just put that in place, and you'll get a picture of whoever's visiting.
Right.
And the other option is to just take some flour or talcum powder.
Barn lime.
Or barn lime or whatever, and sprinkle a thin layer of it on either side of that, and then see what you end up with for tracks.
Yeah. I did. I put some snow in there and, nothing. Of course, the next day I went out and nothing had showed up. So, but I was just really curious of what could move, that's, 30-pound cinder
box. I'd bet on per raccoon, to be honest.
Raccoons may be the most likely, but, I think if the coyote had done it, it was doing it with some ill intent in mind.
For
so
sure.
Oh, I know.
If there was no harm, no foul, then maybe raccoon's the better guess. And while we're on the subject, though, of coyotes, I should point out that this warm weather, and even well before this, the peak of the breeding season started a little while ago for both coyotes, foxes, and a few other things. So
wolves, too, would that be?
Maybe.
Yeah,
but
maybe.
The for those animals, particularly over most of the state, when the coyotes and foxes get going, people tend to hear them more often, see them more often, and that increased activity does allow people to see them a little more frequently.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thanks, Karen. Dan in Duluth, Minnesota. On to you. Hi, Dan.
Hey, guys. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Hey, before I ask my question, that earlier caller, that I think she had a visit from the extremely, extremely rare golden sparrow. so rare that you guys haven't heard of it, obviously. And
could be.
Yeah, so it tends to show up in mild winters. So that's my guess. But,
okay.
The question was also inspired by a previous caller, and just wondering if you have any updates on the spread of the white-nosed bat disease that supposedly is approaching from eastern United States into the Midwest, and
That
has arrived in Wisconsin and Minnesota.
It has not, but it has crept a little closer, and it's... Well, I shouldn't say it's inevitable, but I think the expectation, the realistic expectation is that we'll discover it eventually. But the good news is that Wisconsin has had some time to get ready, and there's an excellent response plan in place, a monitoring plan, and some regulations dealing with cavers and cave protection enclosures and so forth, all designed, if and when it gets here, to minimize both its spread and its impact. So from that standpoint, our bat people are ready for it. I hope it doesn't get here for a while.
Yeah.
But not here yet.
Has the East Coast, have you heard any updates on the populations out there? Are they extremely affected? Or
there have been some cases of very high mortality, but I haven't really seen anything over the last... I think people are so preoccupied by the bizarre warm winter that maybe this has been a good winter from the standpoint of minimizing mortality from white nose, too. Yeah. I just haven't heard anyone talking about
and
that.
And, you know, Judith just reminded me that we'll be talking about bats on the last day of February, February 29th, as part of the new series we're doing with the DNR on the 40th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act. So on February 29th, we don't have our guests determined yet, but we will be zeroing in on that on the 29th.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Preston from our caller from Preston, Minnesota, thinks that mystery bird could be a goldfinch in winter plumage, but as you're saying, Scott, they're a little more greenish in color.
We thought about that kind of off air, but I guess I would describe them as a little more olive green than golden, and usually the wings are darker. They're not a uniform color, who knows?
Sally in Lancaster, on to you. Hi, Sal.
Hi. We had a couple of bats flying around in our church on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a scout meeting Sunday night, and we were talking about the bats and that. And just wondering if there was anything that we should have done with those to try to help keep them alive, or why they would have become active at this time of year, or if there was, you know, basically... anything we could have done to help them.
Is there an attic? You have an attic in the church?
Yeah, there's a belfry in the church.
Well, yeah. Chances,
they roost up there. But.
Chances are the bats were back in the belfry safely tucked in before you could have done much about it anyway. Or were they ultimately captured or shooed out? Or do you not know what happened to them?
Well, the one we shooed back in that general area, but it spent quite a bit of time flying around, and we were just concerned that it was wasting all its energy and wasn't going to find anything to eat.
Well, that's both true on both counts, but it's not uncommon during the winter, especially during a normal thaw, and this has been an abnormally long and warm thaw, for bats that are overwintering in belfries, attics, wall voids, home attics, whatever, to stir and arouse and move around a bit. And ultimately, a few find their way into the living space, and then that causes some consternation about, mm-hmm. holy cow, the bats are moving around and we need to do something. All pretty normal, and I think from the bats' perspective, all you can hope for is that they knew how or found their way back into the colony, and when the temperatures return to more normal winter conditions, you know, they're back there for the rest of the winter and then will exit in the spring and go about their business. But it also, of course, when people encounter bats active during the winter, it's a pretty clear reminder that, uh-oh, we've got some bats in the belfry attic or whatever, and maybe we want to do something about that. So I think the bigger issue for you folks at the church is whether or not you want to continue to support that colony of bats in the church and let them go about their business, or whether you want to do some bat-proofing or other construction activity next spring when the bats are active to exclude them in future winters.
Yeah.
In a normal sense, by February, when things start to warm up, we almost every year have accounts of red bats, which are not a home or building bat, but red bats becoming active or returning from migration or simply becoming active and flying around again during warm weather outside. So it's all quite normal.
Yeah, all quite normal. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. By the way, we have some open lines again, so you can get in with your question at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a comment there or a photo, and you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Scott, you've got a little brochure that I know you wanted to talk about, which is kind of a our money goes and
it's a summary of the public's investment in Wisconsin's fish and wildlife for the last year. And this, in other words, what does the DNR spend on fish and wildlife conservation, and where does the money come from? And it's a neat little summary, and it was an insert in the recent edition of Wisconsin Natural Resources magazine.
That's where I saw it.
Yeah, so anyone who has a subscription to the magazine has a copy of this, and I suspect it's online too. But it's kind of interesting from a fish and wildlife standpoint to look at the budget and where the money went. For example, the total DNR budget for 2010-11, $529 million. The Fish and Wildlife Account Fund's $103 million, which is a little less than 20% of the total. And the $103 million Fish and Wildlife Account comes from the following sources. Almost 67% from licenses and stamps. I mean, two-thirds of the bill is still being paid for by license revenue. So the idea that the fishers and hunters are paying the bills is still very much true. Another 10% or so from federal aid and fish restoration, and another 11% from the Pittman-Robertson program. Those are the excise taxes on arms, ammunition, and fishing tackle. The bottom line is, so anyway, all that money, how was it spent? Well, of the total of a dollar, for example, 28.4 cents on the dollar went to wildlife, 28.6 cents to fisheries, and then the rest is divided up amongst facilities and land, customer service, regional management, law enforcement, and administration. Law enforcement at 18 cents on the dollar, administration only 7 cents on the dollar.
This seems
pretty cost effective. But beyond that, now we know that 28 cents on the dollar went to wildlife. Well, where did it go? And there's a long list here of accomplishments for that money. For example, during the year, they managed 178 state wildlife areas across 620,000 acres. Open for public recreation, wildlife watching, hunting, fishing, and so forth. What else do we have here? There's an account of the elk herd. Counted the elk herd at 150 animals and moved a small group of elk to expand their range, and we had talked about that on previous programs. Assisted almost 33,000 residents with interpretive programs. Helped host a youth outdoor expo, attracting 3,000 students. Expanded the National Archery in the Schools program and hosted the largest indoor archery tournament in Wisconsin for over 700 students. And it goes on and on to talk about harvest statistics, survey information, and a variety of other things. But for someone who's always wondering, gee, I spent $24 for that license. What happened to that money? It's all right there in black and white.
All right.
It seems to be pretty efficiently used to come back to the people who pay the bill. So it works out good.
Works out great. Carolyn and Watoma, we turn to you. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. I thought Scott would be interested. I don't know. When I looked in my bird book, the northern shrike was supposed to be quite uncommon. And I saw one, my husband and I saw one Friday, this last Friday, later in the afternoon. in our backyard. And then Saturday he returned, and much to our surprise, we saw him. Well, he was kind of flitting from tree to bird cedar post from, you know, different
yep.
places.
Sure.
And we saw him dive down into the snow and grab a vole and
cool.
fly up to the tree with it and kind of adjust it in his beak and then flew off for, I'm sure, a little bit more privacy and peace to eat it.
mm-hmm.
But being here in Wautoma, I'm kind of north central in the or south central state. Are they quite uncommon in this area? I had heard that they breed in the tundra, and this is their southern range.
Yeah, it is. Shrikes are not common, not a common thing to see anywhere in the state, but they do turn up occasionally. I guess in the all the years of looking around on my own property, I've only seen one on one occasion. I think a caller had reported seeing one on a previous show, either last month or the month before. So it's always a neat thing to see. I mean, they're a pretty bird for people not familiar with them. They're kind of a gray, a stark gray and black, but they look and act like a songbird about blue jay size. But, of course, they're, one of their nicknames is butcher bird from their habit of impaling prey on a thorn or a barbed wire spike or something like that. So that's what I was. That's where I hoped you were headed when you said you saw him catch a vole that he quickly flew up into a rose bush or something and stuck it on a thorn, but he must have been a little hungrier than wanting to save it for later. So it's always neat to see them, and I wouldn't describe it as a common thing, no matter where you are.
No. Thanks, Carol.
Well, it was really neat to see him. I went through my book because I thought at first he was sitting on the air conditioner close to the house, and at first, because of his beak curl at the end, I thought it was some sort of little hawk.
Mm-hmm.
And frantically looking through my book, couldn't find him in the hawk section, and then just kept paging. So when I found this, it was just the neatest thing. He's a gorgeous bird, and being that we've got storm windows on and such, I couldn't hear him singing, but I understand they have a beautiful song.
Well, mm-hmm. I'm glad you got a chance to experience it.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Carolyn. We have an email from Bonnie. In Waukesha, catalog came in the mail the other day advertising a 20-tube nest starter kit for mason bees. And I don't know if you've ever seen these, small houses to protect the cylinder from the elements and replacement tubes for subsequent years. Have you seen these?
Well, I've seen the nests around that the bees make and, you know, plaster on a wall surface or something like that. But I don't know anything about the...
Yeah.
Artificial provision of same. That would be a good question for our entomological colleague, Phil, next time he's on.
Bonnie, save that for call that one in again when Phil comes on, will you please? Because I'm not sure about it either. I don't recall us talking about it ever, so we'll have to wait on that one. How about Rick in Onalaska? Rick, what's on your mind?
Well, good morning, and I really appreciate the show. I listen to it every day.
Thank you.
But I have two questions. The first one is that I've identified what I believe to be a sharp-shinning hawk that's hanging around my bird feeder.
Mm-hmm.
It's 12 to 18 inches long, and I got the bird book out, and it looks just like a sharp-shinning hawk, and I saw it swoop into one of my spruce trees and come out with a small bird.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if that is what you think that is, and if that's common for western Wisconsin and in the winter. And secondly, I have a bluebird house that was very productive for about 3 years, and then last year the chipping sparrows moved in, and I battled them all summer, but they were very persistent, so I didn't get any bluebird hatches. And I'm wondering if there's any way that you know of any way that I can eliminate that problem so I can get the bluebirds back.
Well, let's take the chipping sparrows first, and I may not be as helpful as you might hope there because I really like chipping sparrows. I think they're among the sparrows, they're a really cute little sparrow, and I enjoy having them visit the yard and the feeders occasionally. So, you know, they've got to nest somewhere as well, so my basic suggestion is put up a couple more boxes, and you may get bluebirds in one and chipping sparrows in the other, and then everybody's happy.
Okay.
That's not a—I mean, the real problem species, the house sparrows, and if the hole size is too big, even starlings or some other pestiferous things or tree swallows that are a common competitor for bluebirds are a little easier to deal with guards and persistently removing the nests, at least of the house sparrows. But I don't know, I'd be tempted to leave the chipping sparrows alone and put up another nest box or two and see if the bluebirds will use that. As far as the raptor at your feeder is concerned, certainly could be a sharpie or a sharp-shinned hawk. But if you go back to your bird book, you'll see that there's a series of three raptors that look very, very similar,
very
except
close.
For size. So yeah. The sharpie's the small one, the Cooper's hawk's the middle-sized one, and the goshawk's the bigger one. Now, of the three, in terms of people grumbling about them being around a feeder, by far the Cooper's hawk is the most common culprit here. But
it didn't have the markings of a Cooper's hawk. It had the variegated tail and the color of a sharp.
Well, it depends a lot on the sex and age class of the bird, because within the same sex and age class, they're mighty hard to tell apart except by size. And a sharpie is a very small bird, not a lot bigger than a blue jay. So
okay.
If it was bigger than that, I'm going to say you've got a Cooper's hawk. But if it was a small bird that looked like that, and I mean small for a hawk, kestrel or sparrowhawk size or even smaller, then it certainly could be a sharp shin. But they're not, much like the discussion of the shrikes, they're more common than shrikes, but not everybody doesn't have one in their backyard. So.
Yeah. There you go.
It's always hard to describe relative abundance, because if you have one, you have one. And for you, it's common. You see it every day. But for all the neighbors around, they never get to see one. So I'd check the size carefully again next time you see it. It could be a sharpie. Go ahead.
Okay. It definitely was much bigger. It was probably four times the size of a blue jay.
Then there's no question.
No question about it then. You've got Mr. Cooper's hawk.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Otherwise, you would have a Sharpie on steroids or something.
That would be a big one.
That would be a really big one. Scott Craven, UW wildlife ecologist, emeritus professor, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a question for Scott Craven, our wildlife ecologist, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Ruth in Madison up next with a question. Hi, Ruth.
Oh, yes. Sorry. I have two questions, actually. Maybe three. Regarding Canada geese, last Friday I saw between 20, 25 geese in their usual V, honking along, and I'm wondering, are they really late heading south, or do we have a resident year-round population here?
Oh, Madison area, we have a resident.
We have lots of resident geese.
But year-round?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, then the other thing is, has anybody speculated why they make so much noise calling to each other? Because it seems to me that would be a waste of energy.
Well, they all that calling has more meaning to the geese than it does to us, but they are very vocal and communicate with each other frequently. For one thing, there are several levels of organization in geese that you might not see in other birds that are a little more quiet. For one thing, they stay in pairs and family units quite a bit longer than many birds. So there's communication between mates and between family members. And then the families aggregate into these flocks like you saw, and there's some communication there too, as well as who's leading the pack and who's bringing up the rear and a variety of other things. What they're saying to each other in goose, I have no idea. But they have some social organization that they need to maintain, and I'm sure the vocalizations relate to that.
Okay, and the third quick question. I really do not expect you to be able to answer this, but when they spray these flame retardant chemicals down over forest and fires and range fires, I'm wondering, has anybody studied whether that has any impact, detrimental or otherwise, on not only the plant life and the animal life and even bacteria in the soil that might come back up after the fire's out?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting question. I suspect if I don't know of anyone who's checked the negative effects of that, but I suspect the answer is going to be, well, maybe there's some impact, but the impact of the pending fire is probably a lot more detrimental on all concerned. Therefore, the use of the retardant is justified. But I don't know how inert. I would think that if it's simply a retardant, that it's not a particularly chemically active or complicated substance that either dissipates over time or is consumed by the fire as it's putting it out or whatnot. So that's not something that I have either heard is a big problem or is likely to be. And again, the needs of extinguishing the fires may supersede whatever's there.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. We had a nice email from Todd in Crawford County, whose 8-year-old daughter Willow is convinced that flying squirrels are a mythical creature that I made up and will not believe anyone that they exist. Would you please talk about our flying squirrels in Wisconsin? She's in school now, but I can replay the show for her tonight. And I have an 8-year-old, so I kind of know how this goes. So I hope you can help out here, Scott.
Well, this is an easy one. Flying squirrels are just adorable little animals. They are a native squirrel here in Wisconsin, surprisingly common. So I would guess that everybody who lives somewhere near a treed environment, whether it's a green space, a park, or rural property, has flying squirrels much closer than they think they do. The problem is that our flying squirrels, and I say squirrels because there are two of them, the southern flying squirrel, which is a little smaller and found statewide, and the northern flying squirrel, which is almost twice the size and restricted to some smaller areas in the northern part of the state. So there are two species. They're strictly nocturnal, almost never seen out during the daylight. So unless you have a bird feeder rigged up with either a red filtered light or they've become accustomed to a regular white light enough that you can watch them coming into a bird feeder at night, or you happen to cut down an old tree as part of a cleanup or firewood operation, and when it hits the ground and fractures, there's flying squirrels going every which way that happen to have a den in there. Those are the kinds of times people tend to encounter them. They also get into people's attics occasionally, and despite the fact that they're pretty beautiful, soft little things with that big rudder-like tail and gigantic eyes, they're still a squirrel, and they can do some damage to insulation and wiring and so forth, so sometimes people actually want to get rid of them rather than attract them. But the short answer is, yes, we have flying squirrels in Wisconsin, and yes, there are quite a few of them, and yes, they're beautiful little, very soft-furred things with big eyes, very attractive. You just don't get to see them very often.
And I hope that Todd has a chance to play this back for his 8-year-old daughter. On to Owen in Ledgeview. Hi, Owen.
How you doing? Appreciate it. Hey, regarding the conversation on coyotes, they're out in Ledgeview, which is east of the pier. Mm-hmm. Hearing a lot of howling going on out there, especially going down GV when the police cars and other sirens are going, they're howling, which gets my dog excited. Now, if my dog goes after those, are they in a pack? Would they turn on him? Would I have to worry about that? And he would do it out of curiosity, of course.
Well, this is a very common question, Owen, and it's a very difficult one to answer. Coyotes are certainly implicated in causing lots of difficulty for pets, particularly cats, small dogs, and there have been accounts of attacks on humans in different parts of North America. Not in terms of human risk, nothing too serious reported in Wisconsin. In terms of pet losses, I think cats just kind of vanish because they're often let out to go about their business, which we could, that's another whole story.
Right.
But the cat just vanishes. You never really know what happened to it. But even here in Madison, there have been a couple of recent accounts of people actually seeing the coyotes making off with their pet. I think one was a dachshund recently and other small dogs, and they're simply killed and lugged off. Generally speaking, members of the dog family don't play well together. So wolves don't like coyotes. Coyotes don't like fox. coyotes, with, as far as dogs are concerned, it depends entirely on the context, the circumstance. I've had people send in home videos of coyotes play, what looks like playing with their dogs in the backyard. No harm, no foul. We've had other cases where small dogs, as I said, have been killed. And, of course, there are coy dog, in some parts of the world, hybrids, where, you know, rather than killing each other, they're mating with each other.
Yeah.
So the responses are highly variable and difficult to predict. But while I think the risk posed by coyotes is relatively small, it obviously is a finite risk, and prudence is in order. But what might happen if your dog runs off to see what's going on, I can't tell you for sure.
Well,
but I would try and restrain the dog if I had the opportunity to do so.
Well, with that said, then my daughter wants to camp out in a tent in the backyard this summer. She's 11 years old. The concern sounds minor, then?
Very minor. I mean, you know, right up there with, you know, somebody losing control on the road going by the house and driving through the backyard. You know, meteorites, a whole host of other
lightning
things.
Lightning
strikes. You know, all those things are possible, but we tend to kind of disregard them because they're so unusual. And coyotes maybe are a slight step up from that, but not a major, especially for, you know, an 11-year-old right in the backyard. That strikes me as...
In a tent.
I can't say it's impossible, but it's darn near.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling. Nettie in Pittsville. On to you now. Hi, Nettie.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to tell everybody that about a week and a half ago, it was a nice sunny day and not too cold, that I saw approximately a dozen cedar waxwings eating, I don't know if the seeds are just the flesh of an apple in a greening tree.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh.
This is January, not May.
Well, Nettie, I've had a couple emails in the last week or so of flocks of robins doing the same thing. People are reporting bluebird activity. But the reality is that for those species, some of them remain in Wisconsin all or almost all winter every year, even in a seemingly normal winter. For robins, especially around springs or flowing water, where they can find water and some dried fruits and whatnot, for whatever reason, a few of those birds of those species I mentioned are going to stay around no matter what. So it's not necessarily a response to the weather and holy cow, everything's returning that much earlier, although I have to say the daffodils are up an inch and a half on the south side of my house right now, which makes me very nervous. But anyway, waxwings are a pretty bird and neat to see at any time of the year.
Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Bob in Fifield, on to you. Hi, Bob.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I was out walking my yellow lab, this was probably late November, and I'm pretty aware of wildlife around here, and I have deer and all kinds of wildlife, and this is like Northern Price County, Ashland County. I was wondering, I saw a track, and this was before the snow was on the ground. I saw a track of, it appeared to be a deer track, but it was, like, huge. And I was, it looked at, to me, that it was a moose. And I was wondering, is there any moose population in our area, in Price County, Northern Price County, Ashland County?
Where are you? I saw your email here on the screen, Bob, and I have a place in Northern Price County in the town of Fifield. So I mean, holy cow, there's a moose in my backyard. But
I live on Old 13 Road in Price County, and it's kind of an area where there is a lake north of me. And there is a creek that runs north of me. There is quite a bit of swampland or lowland.
It's good moose habitat. And,
yeah,
and the reality is a moose track would look like a gigantic deer track.
That's exactly what it looked like.
So,
it had the two toes sticking out, but it was like twice as Oh, probably.
At least twice.
Okay.
Twice or three times as big as any deer track I've ever seen. And I was just astounded. If I would have had a digital camera, I would have taken a picture of it.
Well, I'm not aware of any specific sightings recently in that area, but two things. First of all, there are some moose, you know, a dozen, maybe several dozen, meandering around northern Wisconsin, and they can cover a lot of real estate. They're mostly animals that have trickled over from the population in the UP.
Maybe some.
And a few
Minnesota.
Years ago, we had a documented calf. I mean, there are some up there, but not very many. So it's quite possible. And if you want to kind of check on the current sense of what's going on up there, not very far from you, you could check with our good friend Adrian, the DNR mammologist at the Park Falls office of the DNR. And Adrian keeps track of these kinds of things.
Adrian,
that's part of his job. Mm-hmm. So you could either stop by there or get a hold of him and see if he's aware of any sightings in your area over the last few months.
Yeah, good. Thanks very much for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, with us until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network. The diversity and richness of Wisconsin wildlife is one of the many things that make our state, I think, such a special place to live. And it brings visitors from all over the place. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Lucky to have wildlife ecologist Scott Craven as our guide to the outdoors for the next half hour. And he has some great ideas for ways to enjoy the outdoors and to be good stewards of nature. You may have a question about our wildlife, or you may be wondering about some animals that you have seen, or maybe have spotted some critters nearby, just not sure what they are. You can join in. Call us at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org. And I hope you'll visit our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show. Click like when you're there to get regular updates on upcoming show topics. And we'd love to have you join the show. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here taking a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Great to have him along. Thank you so much for listening in, and I hope you'll join in. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can post a photo or a question or a comment there. Scott, this kind of wild weather out there, isn't it? Wild, warm weather.
Well, it's been pretty wild. It's been great, though, from my standpoint.
Yeah.
And I think that given the weather and the recent arrival of a lot of my seed catalogs and the fact that, as I mentioned, my daffodils in the front yard are up about an inch on the south side of the house, which is problematic, it seems like pretty good timing for the big garden expo coming up next week. And I guess we're both going to be there.
We are both going to be there on Saturday. Now, this is a week from...
the 11th.
Yeah, it's the 11th.
I think.
Yeah, so it's a week from this weekend. We'll be there. I'll be doing a little presentation with Shelley Ryan and some other folks at 10 o'clock on that Saturday morning. And then I'll be at our booth, our Wisconsin Public Radio booth, from 11 o'clock to 12 o'clock. So I'll be meeting people there. So I hope you stop by. And Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, will also be there. And you're coming by about noon, aren't you?
I think I'm supposed to be there from 1 to 2, but I'll probably come by a little earlier to look around since there's always a lot of neat stuff to see.
So. Oh, absolutely. You know, we've got some tickets to give away. Why don't we do that? You want to do that?
Yeah, let's do that.
Let's do that. Okay, I'll tell you what. You can email in to talk@wpr.org. And the next five people who email in and tell us who your favorite garden person is, garden talk person on Fridays, say that. And tell you what, Judith will fix you up with a pair of tickets. So let's do it that way. Next five, should we do that, Judith? Let's do five. Okay, we'll do five. We'll give away pairs of tickets.
A really good deal.
And you have to kind of half promise to come and see us.
Well, that'd be good. I think I'll bring some of my garden pest animals along. If anybody has questions, we can show them what they... It's hard to show people what this stuff looks like on the radio. But
yeah.
At the Garden Expo, we can do that.
Yep. And so that's February 11th. And be there or be square. And email right now and we'll send you some tickets. We'll give you some tickets. And Peter in Milwaukee has comments. So let's go there. Hi, Peter.
Good afternoon, I guess. I'm glad to be able to talk to you guys. 2 days ago, I was traveling north on 94 by Ryan Road, and there was a huge flock, several thousand birds, that kept a formation of a circular round ball.
Mm-hmm.
And as they flew north, I was traveling about 50 miles an hour. And obviously, you just glanced to the right and see if they, you know, if they were able to stay with the traffic. But it was amazing how they kept their round formation. They were black, kind of small. But usually, you don't see these birds until the end of March, it seems like. Mm-hmm. And to see them so early in the year, it kind of like tells me that spring is next week. The fact that they kept their round formation so dramatically was just an amazing sight. And I wish I would have had a camera. I wish I wouldn't have been driving on the interstate. It was really something to observe.
Okay.
Well, a couple of things from that observation, Peter. First of all, the coordination of a flock of birds in terms of how in the heck did they all turn at the same time in the same direction is one of those amazing things about nature that people are fascinated with. They were probably mixed blackbirds, mostly red wings, probably. And it is awfully early to see a big flock back. But a lot of these birds in the spring kind of move north following the thaw line, essentially the 32-degree isotherm. And as things are thawing, they move north. And if things retreat back into normal winter weather, then they'll simply fall back to a point where they get below the freezing line again and will spend some more time until eventually they return for good. I think it's truly very early for big flocks like that to come back. But on the other hand, a lot of bird arrival dates have advanced by a week or two over the past few years, presumably in response to more long-term climate changes. And hopefully that's not what we're seeing with that group of blackbirds.
Right. And the other thing was usually in the fall you'll see them in a longer group of formations, more lengthier type. But this one was it just was amazing at how they kept their formation. If you were to say it looked like a large basketball in the sky, that would be the correct
thing. Yeah, we've seen that often. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Judith says we've got plenty of responses for those tickets to Garden Expo already, and we'll give out. Are we going to give out the names? Yeah, we'll give out. You want to give the names? Okay, we'll give the names out. I'm looking at her in another. She's in another studio, but we've got visual contact here. She says she'll give me those names, and we'll read them off. And by the way, we'll be giving away. You'll have other chances, and in the next 10 days. Probably try to do something almost as many days as we can, certainly, to give away tickets for Garden Expo. And I didn't mention it, but it is in Madison at the Alliant Energy Center, the 11th and 12th are the big 2 days, Saturday and Sunday. But there is something Friday. I think it starts Friday afternoon, actually. But Saturday and Sunday, and Scott and I will be there Saturday. So you should be there, too. Russell in Rio, it's your turn. Hi, Russell.
The other day I put out a rat live trap, and in the morning there was a single dead mouse, partially eaten. And the next day there was more eaten, and by the third day there wasn't hardly anything left.
Uh-huh.
Can a pygmy shrew get through half-inch hardware cloth?
No problem. Yeah, if anything that was eaten like that mysteriously in a live trap, that's the work of a shrew. And in most cases, where was the trap? Was it in a garage?
Yep.
Yeah. It's common for both mice and shrews to be in a garage over winter. They're both interested in the same shelter, but whereas the mice are interested in your bird seed or dog food or whatever else they can scavenge, the shrews are in there to dine on mice. And it's quite common, whether you catch a mouse in a snap trap or in a live trap, to find nothing but essentially the head or scalp and a little bit of hide, and the shrew's eaten everything else. So shrews are our friends in that regard. And I think the half-inch mesh, even a short-tailed shrew, which is more common in the garages in the winter, could still get through there and consume that mouse.
Yeah. I've had many short-tailed shrews meet their end in my garage here.
That's kind of sad.
Yeah.
Because they're not, I mean, the shrews are in there not to do dastardly things to your stored jackets or dog food or whatever else, but rather to work on the rodents and get a little shelter. So, unfortunately, that's kind of collateral damage in a trapping program.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much for calling. Susan in Coon Valley, hi to you.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think we had a wonderful experience. I believe it was spring of last season. We were in Price County on Highway 8 visiting friends that have lived there most of their lives. And we were going down Highway 8, and a mother, bobcat, and two babies crossed the road no more than 50 feet in front of our car. And there were four of us in the car, so we all saw the same thing. And we were all very amazed that they would be moving and, you know, expose themselves in the open. And I'm just wondering if anybody else has had that experience.
Well, I can only speak for myself, and I have not.
Me
bobcats, bobcats are secretive animals and not commonly seen, especially not with kittens, but you got to see a really cool thing.
Yes.
Why they were crossing the road, who knows? Kind of like the chicken crossing the road story, but you were lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time, and I'm pleased that it was in Price County. As the wildlife sightings in Price County continue to mount, I'm really glad I've got a place up there. So thanks very much for that sighting, Susan.
Yeah,
if anybody else has seen a bobcat with kittens,
let us know.
Let us know.
Absolutely. Thank you again, Susan. John in De Pere, on to you. Hi, John.
Hi. Great show. Love the show.
Thank you.
Two questions for you. I was up at my cabin in Monaco this weekend with some people fishing, and a number of them talked about and showed the pictures of, and didn't know if you heard of it, the cougar that was apparently hit and killed by a vehicle between Monaco and Rhinelander. And secondly, just wondered if you could identify something. When I go pheasant hunting south of De Pere on a number of occasions and we're in the tall grass, a bird will come out. Unfortunately, it's not a pheasant, but it looks like a long wing, some type of hawk that's coming out of the long grass and just kind of flies around the long grass here. I was wondering if you know what kind of bird that is.
Well, it could be a marsh hawk, especially if you did you happen to notice one distinctive feature on those birds, and they will just kind of flap around over open grassy areas. It's got a very distinctive white patch on its rump. But there are other things possible, too. I've flushed owls. Short-eared owls will come out of the grass like that and meander around, but those are a couple possibilities.
I've seen the owls, too, but this hawk has kind of long, slender wings. And
yeah, I think a marsh hawk or harrier, is probably the best bet. But the most important thing here, John, I think, is did you catch anything?
Yes.
Yes, we did get a few walleyes and some perch. So.
Oh, excellent.
Right. Well,
okay, good show. We don't hardly get to go out, so we have to enjoy vicarious experiences from other fisher persons. So.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for calling. You know, I'm on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and I'm seeing some great photos.
Oh, look at that.
Here's one from Brian in Glendale. So Glendale, that's got to be a coyote there.
Yeah, it looks like it.
Looks like a coyote, and what else have we got? We got an eagle picture. We've got, some deer shedding.
There's a couple of bucks. Yep.
There's two of them there shedding their antlers. There's this from Gerald. There's a snowy owl. And here's another one from Gerald. What do we got there? We've got a hawk.
That looks like a goshawk, but it
could be a goshawk. Hard to tell, but it's a nice close-up. And here's a pileated, believe.
That's a very nice picture of a pileated.
Yeah. And there's another snowy owl from Oconee County with Jill. Send that. That's pretty cool. Plus, we've got some links to UW Extension, the one on bats, houses. Mm-hmm. So lots there on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. So I hope you'll go to it. I hope you'll go to it. These ducks have been evading us for 11 years on the Menominee River, 13 miles of North America. Do you know What those ducks are, it's hard to say. Could be golden eyes. Look at this
where
one.
Where are they?
Right here. See that? Is that a golden?
Oh. I'm going to have to get up and move a little closer to the screen layer. My telephoto vision isn't so good.
Well, take a look. I would need to get it closer too, but it looks like we've got a partial white head there. Maybe a golden eye.
No, that one's excellent. That's a hooded merganser.
Oh, there we go. The man is really good because that's
least
a small
picture. The one with the white and black crest is a male hooded merganser. Beautiful duck.
Yeah, they're really beautiful animals. So there, Donna, there's your answer. And here's Stella in Sturgeon Bay with a question or comment about Canada geese, I believe. Hi, Stella.
Hi. I actually have two questions about Canada geese. We have a little mystery that for 2010 and 11, a pair of geese nested on an area that was an old commercial shipyard. Mm-hmm. And they nested on a peninsula that was surrounded by the metal sheathing, and it was at least a 6 to 8 foot drop to the water, mm-hmm. or anywhere that they can get. It's at least a third to a half mile to any area that would have a gradual slope into the water to be able to walk into the water, and. In 2010, we were walking past there every day, and so we know the day that the geese, that they hatched, and they had disappeared. The goslings, my question is, can goslings survive a drop to the water of 6 to 8 feet?
No problem.
Yeah.
No problem. Okay.
No, I mean, wood duck ducklings will drop 30 or 40 feet onto the ground. And just essentially bounce and away they go. But for the goslings to hit the water like that when they're those little fuzzballs is probably no problem at all.
Okay. And the second question is, we went through a period of cold weather. We walk along along Sturgeon Bay, the bay of Sturgeon Bay,
mm-hmm.
and we went through a period of a long enough stretch of cold weather that the bay was completely frozen over.
Mm-hmm.
And the geese, we have both migratory Canada geese and resident Canada geese. And the resident geese had been in the water and on the shore all the way up until when it froze over, and then there were none. And then we had a warm spell, and the bay thawed out in the middle, and all of a sudden there were geese out in the middle. And my question is, where do they go when it's all frozen over?
Hmm. Oh, it's generally no problem for those birds to fly somewhere where there's a power plant outflow or moving water or something else where they can find some open water and then return when conditions are better. You know, for them to fly
10 miles
either way is no problem at all.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you much for calling. Appreciate your call. Email from Sue in Madison. Does the overwintering bear's heart rate lower like the hibernating bat heart rate supposedly does? And is there a bear den webcam available somewhere? And there is. I've actually been on it, the webcam, but I can't I don't have that at the tip of my tongue. Maybe Judith knows it.
I'm guessing if you Googled something like that, you'd probably find
there is a webcam. And there's a bear that is actually, they were watching to see when it would have its young.
Yes, I remember that too, but I can't remember the
Yeah, I went to it. But if you go to Bear Den Webcam, you're almost sure to find that.
Maybe even multiples.
But what about the heart rate?
Their changes are not as dramatic as for true hibernators that are, you know, dropped to very low rates. So yeah, there's some decline, but it's not as dramatic as for some mammals.
We have Jane and Madison up next. Hi, Jane. Thank you for calling.
Hi. About a week before the ice fishermen came on the lake, a wolf-like animal walked across the lake, sat down for about 45 minutes, howled, walked away again, came back, howled again. And my neighbor thought it looked like a wolf. My daughter has a coyote head on her wall, and it didn't look like that. Is it really possible that it was a wolf?
Well,
not very likely in Lake Mendota.
Possible, but not very likely. And over the years, I've had lots of accounts of people seeing coyotes meandering around out on the ice, and they'll go out on the ice too after the ice fishermen have been out there, simply because there's an occasional abandoned fish, drop fish, bait fish, or whatever out there that's a food source. So it's a lot easier for a coyote who wants to get from point A to point B to walk across a nice windswept bit of ice than to march through somebody's backyard and across roads. So the likelihood is far greater for coyote, but I mean, one can never say never about any of these things.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, just wondered. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. And, you know, we had so many people email about the getting the tickets to the Garden Expo that Judith just said, you know what, we're going to give out 10 pairs. So we have 10 pairs, 10 winners. Katina T, Cynthia H, Jackie S, Sharon R, Jerry S, Jean J, Ellen W, Timothy B, Phil B, and Richard M. And favorite guests, well, there were a lot of favorite. For Garden Talk, this was, of course, Melinda Myers and Shelley Ryan, pretty close there. Neil DeBole got some from Prairie Nursery, got some things there. And we will be in touch with the winners. Judith will get a hold of you. So in one way or another. And thank you for entering. And we'll be doing this again. We'll do this. We'll try and do this several days. It's just sort of in ahead of the Garden Expo, which is the weekend of the 11th.
Looks like we'll be seeing lots of folks there.
Yeah. Now, you guys all have to come by the Wisconsin Public Radio booth. We got a really nice booth we're going to have. I'll be there. Scott will be there. A whole bunch of people are going to be there over those couple of days at different points in time. And Scott's going to have some, you're going to have some stuffed animals or birds or whatever.
I'll lug something along.
Okay. Cy in Portage, it's your turn. Hi, Cy.
Hi. Happy spring.
To you as well.
On the Wednesday before Christmas, I was found in my backyard with the camera chasing around a totally white bird. And it was with some chickadees, and I, you know, it kind of acted like a chickadee, but I'm not sure what it was. It was the size of a chickadee. Is it possible it was a white chickadee?
Sure.
Okay.
Albinos turn up in wide range of birds on occasion. It's not common, but over the years we've had pictures and reports of white robins, white blackbirds,
really?
All sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
It was the coolest thing. I have a picture, but I'm the only one that would know where to look to see the white dot. Okay, well, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Judith did some looking around. It's bear for the webcam of the bear that's hibernating, bear.org. And two babies were born last Sunday. So just this past Sunday, there were a couple babies born on the web. You would have had a chance to see it on the webcam.
Cool.
Yeah, very cool. And an email from Maryland in Richland County says, we have a black bear hibernating on our farm. When will the bear become active? Is the warm weather we're experiencing a trigger for the bear to come out, take a look around?
I think probably not. Interesting, bears and bobcats and a number of other things seem to be extending their reach down into areas like Richland County and in the Southwest. So that's interesting in and of itself. But I think it's going to be another month or longer before there's much probability that these animals will truly be out wandering around for good. This can't possibly last.
I don't think so.
So.
We have a listener wonders that 30 years ago in southern Missouri, there was a game warden with the last name of Craven. Any relation?
Not that I'm aware of.
Not that.
as you know, Larry, I'm from New England and a very small family. I'm an only child. In fact, I just don't have any immediate relatives even that I know of now with that last name. So
maybe it was a
sure tale. Anything's possible. Could be.
Scott, we'll see you in about a month.
I'll be back in a month. And
but
I,
we actually, well, before that, we'll see you on February 11th at the Garden Expo.
Garden Expo. And I hope that Willow listens to the Flying Squirrel account. And
by the way, they don't really fly. They glide.
That's correct.
Somebody wanted to mention that. Scott Craven, our guest, and he will be back again to talk with us. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.